Better. There we go. All right. Sorry about that. Good morning. I don't know if the cold weather's got some people out or what they're visiting or what. We do have some visiting people this morning. We are in the Divided Kingdom. Actually, lesson 12 today. We're crossing that halfway finished, halfway through the quarter block. I think there's 23 classes this quarter, so this will get us halfway through. Kind of seeing where we are as far as the kings is concerned. We've used this chart a bunch of times already. Go through it one more time. Remember, just keeping in mind always that when we're looking at Judah, the kings of Judah, we're talking about the lineage of Christ. It's the lineage of David and the ancestors of Christ. It's David down through Christ. He's coming through that king reign down through there. We're friend Jehoshaphat now. He's the one that's king in Judah at this time. Israel, Ahab has just died. And Ahaziah, his son, took over. Ahaziah fell through the roof last class. We'll get some review on that. And he has died. And Jehoram, his brother, not his son, his brother takes over for him. Of course, they have a sister, Athaliah. She's going to actually marry Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram. So we're going to have a Jehoram king in Judah and Jehoram king in Israel at the same time coming up here. And then Athaliah is going to kill all of her grandkids except one, and she's going to be queen over in Judah. So a lot of complicated things coming up. I keep putting this chart up over and over because it does get so complex in this little area here. All right, a little review type stuff to catch us up here. Ahab's reigned 22 years in Israel in the northern kingdom. Evil king, worse than anybody before him. Not just bad like Jeroboam, but worse and worse and worse and worse. The spiral goes down, particularly with his wife Jezebel and all the Baal worship in there. Ahaziah, his son, has taken over and reigned for 2 years. And then he is going to fall through this upper chamber, lattice work, according to exactly how you read it, and injured. And he then sends the messengers out to find out from the prophets of Beelzebub would he recover or not. And Elijah meets him and says, go back and tell him, why are you seeking word from there? Is it not a prophet of the Lord you can ask here? And send the words back to him that you're going to die. You won't get off your bed, your deathbed. And he does. He has no son, so his brother Jehoram takes over as king. He's the son of Ahab and Jezebel also. So he's now king in his place. So Ahab, his son Ahaziah, his other son, Jehoram, is now reigning in Israel. So Jehoshaphat is still king down in Judah. Of course, Jehoshaphat's a good king, following his father Asa, 41 years of good king, and then 25 more years with Jehoshaphat as a good king. So things are going quite well in Judah, not so good in Israel, of course. And it seems like maybe about this time, Jehoram, who is Jehoshaphat's son, may be reigning with him. A co-regent type is set up here. There's some hint of that going on here. So that, if that's true, we got Jehoram and Jehoram both getting to the thrones here. So leaving the kingdoms there a little bit, we got Elijah and Elisha. Elijah's about to be taken back up, taken into heaven in the whirlwind. He asks Elisha, what can I do for you before I'm taken away? He asked for a double portion of his spirit. And as they're walking together, after going across the Jordan to the east side, they're separated by a chariot and horses of fire. And Elijah's taken up to heaven in the whirlwind, leaving Elisha then to go back and pick up the work that he's been with his mentor doing this time. So here's what our kings look like now. Jehoshaphat is in Judah and Jehoram is in Israel. We've got Athaliah, same chart I showed you there several times there. Let's go on that with the bold ones now, Jehoshaphat and Jehoram are actual kings right now. So moving into today, we're in 2 Kings chapter 3. I have that one chapter. This is kind of a short narrative today as we go through just this one chapter today. So 2 Kings chapter 3. All right, this is not a real clear map, but it really shows what we need to see here quite well. All right, Israel, the orange up here, And of course, Samaria is right at the very top up there, the capital. Judah, down here with Jerusalem, his capital. And then the others we got to look at today are Moab, over here, right opposite the Dead Sea from Judah, and Edom, down here. We know the Moabites, the Ammonites are, sons of Lot. Edom, the followers of Esau, descendants of Esau, which would be very, of course, all these people related here back through Abraham. So we're going to have Judah and Israel coming together to go and pick it up Edom and go to war against Moab. That's what I'm going to say, all the countries laid out. So Israel, Judah, Edom are going to go to war against Moab. There. Okay. Ahab had Moab under subjection. And then when he died, they start rebelling against Israel and the son they're taking over there. And if you look, there's a, what was it, 100,000 lambs and 100,000 wolves, 100,000 sheep or rams every year that they have to get to them up there. So to cut that income off coming into the kingdom would be quite a blow there. So, but they rebelled against them. And so Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir. When you see Mount Seir, that's talking about Edom. So they've all come together against Judah. We've already had that a little bit. So Jehoram wants to go back. Jehoram in Israel wants to go back and take Moab and get them back under subjection to him. So to do that, Jehoram, king in Israel, asked Jehoshaphat, king in Judah, to go with him to war. So we got Jehoram in Israel, Jehoshaphat in Judah that are going to go to war against Moab because they have rebelled against Israel. It's a complicated mess, doesn't it? Don't forget, this is not the first time something like this has happened. Earlier when Ahab wanted to go back and take the city of Ramoth-Gilead, he got Jehoshaphat to go to war with him. That's the war when prophets of Baal said, yeah, go, you'll win. And they called in the prophet from the Lord. And he said, no, you won't. If you go, you won't come back. And that's the one, the battle where Ahab got killed. So it's not the first time they've been together in battle here. So since Moab has also been fighting against Judah, this is not a hard decision for Jehoshaphat to make because Moab's been giving him trouble. So now he's going to team up with Israel, Jehoram, and Judah, and they'll go together and fight against Moab. So Jehoram sends a messenger down to Jehoshaphat, and think about where it is again. Moab is right directly across the Dead Sea. So to go from Judah across to Moab, you got to go around the north end of the Dead Sea or around the south end of the Dead Sea. You can't just go straight across there. So Jehoram says, okay, which way are we going to go? Jehoshaphat says, we're going around the south side. So he had to come down then. Israel bring their army down through Judah as they get ready to go around the south side and fight against Moab. Now, Edom, which is on the very southern tip down there, we'll see another mountain in a minute, is right on the way. So as they go down, Israel picks up Judah and the two to go together and pick up the king of Edom. And now we've got three kings going up against Moab. The mountain city. So, here we go. So we got Israel up here. Jehoram coming down with Jehoshaphat here. And they go around and down around the Dead Sea. They're going to pick up the Edomites. And that king, you have one, two, three kings going up to fight against the king of Moab. So that's kind of where we are. So, Jehoshaphat says, you come down, meet me, we'll go around the south end of the Dead Sea. Area down there is very, very, very dry. So you can imagine what it's like with a couple of armies coming down, with all their people, with all their animals, and they gotta have water. Well, they get down this dry land down here, and after marching for 7 days without water, they come up and said, the Lord bring us out here, and now the Lord's having going to put us out because we have no water to drink. All this. So they start looking about what we're going to do. So somebody, one of the messengers, comes in and says, Elisha is here. Elisha's a prophet now that's taken over for Elijah. So Elisha's here. So the three kings, the king of Israel, Jehoram, the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, and the king of Edom go up to talk to Elisha. Elisha doesn't react real well to this. In fact, he pretty much tells Jehoram, go away. I don't want to talk to you. Go back and talk to the prophets of your mama and your daddy. Or go back to the prophets of Baal, the prophets of Ahab and Jezebel would have used. What are you coming to see me for? And that's kind of the way it's been in Israel all this time. All these times they've gone to the prophets of Baal, and Elijah's been there trying to turn them around, show them many times through the battles and things that God was still there, God was still wanted them back, but they refused it. So when it comes to Elisha, he says, Jehoram, I don't want to talk to you. Go away. But he says, because of Jehoshaphat, Judah is a good king, I will talk to you. I will see what the Lord has to say about this. So we're going to talk about this some more. We'll get toward the end of the class here a little bit. But you got two kings worshiping idols, the Edomites and Israelites, and you got Judah and the influence of Jehoshaphat. And Elisha agrees then to seek God's information for him. So he calls for a musician, a harpist to come in, and when he plays, the Lord tells him what's going on and what's going to happen. And here's the answer about the water. Very, very dry land. Keep it in mind. Basically, God tells him these dry creek beds, these dry river beds where water would rain or would run when the rains came, they're going to be filled with water. But there'll be no wind. There'll be no rain. There'll be no clouds. There'll be nowhere for the water to come from. The water's going to be there. When you get up tomorrow, water will be in these dry creek beds, just filled with it. But there'll be no sign of where it came from. So that's the miracle there. Thus says the Lord, you'll not see wind, not see rain, the valley will be filled with water that you could drink, your animals and your cattle can drink. So that's the message that the Lord gave him about the water. But he adds, and by the way, he said, this is a simple thing for the Lord. And why would it not be? I'm reminded of Jesus in the New Testament when he stilled the storm. Why would he not steal the storm? Why would he not have the power to steal the storm? Who made all the elements of nature anyhow? God did. Of course, Jesus was there with him at the creation. We know that. So for God to do this or for Jesus to steal the storm, this is just a simple matter aside of the Lord. It's no big deal to handle this. But he said also he's going to deliver you out of the hands of the Moabites. You're going to win the battle. Your three kings are going to win the battle. That's the second part of the message that Elisha gave them there. He also tells them some very specific things to do to Moab when you get there. So when you get there, you're to take rocks and you're to put them in every good field. Put stones out there. Essentially, it won't be good for plowing or raising crops anymore. You cut down every good tree. You fill up every spring with water. And essentially, you're going to ruin the land. What it amounts to. So when you get there and you attack them, these are the things you're supposed to do specifically when you get there to just ruin the land of Moab. What it amounts to. That's the instructions. You'll have water. You'll win the battle. And when you get there, here's what you're supposed to do once you get there. So, next morning they get up. Guess what? All the ditches are full of water. Just like God said it would be through Elisha's prophet. Now, Moab army gets up, and these dry creek beds where water would run normally, there's been no rain. They see this reflection of the light coming off the sun, and they think They're full of blood, not water, as they see them. So they think, oh, these armies all got mad at one another and killed one another. And this is the blood running out from this humongous battle here. And that would be the first time I say that happened either. The other battles when the armies turned against each other and had war among themselves. We've seen that happen before too. So that's what the Moabite army says. So they come in, okay, if they've all had war against each other and killed each other and have all this big blood running through here, let's go get the spoils. So Moab takes in and heads into where the camps are here. They're going in thinking everybody's dead. So let's talk about that. Come on, clicker. So they come in and take the spoils of the land, and the three armies get up, and they attack them, and they just rout the Moabites, just like Elisha said. So then they go into the cities, and they start destroying the cities. So these men take the stone and throws it in the fields as they go out there. They cut down the good trees, and they fill the springs up, and they ruin the land just like Elisha told them to. Now the sad part. King Moab takes 700 of his swordsmen. He tries to break through the line to get out. Can't do it. So he gets in the city, and the different commentaries read different ways as exactly how this came about based on the actual original language and what comes through with it. But it appears as though he took his eldest son, who would have been king in his place, and he gets on the wall some way so that the armies kept around the city, the Israelite armies, can see what's going on, and he sacrifices his eldest son to their gods, trying to appease them and to defeat the armies that have him in captivity here. And verse 27, the last verse of the chapter here, took his eldest son who would have reigned in his place, offered him as a burnt offering on the wall. And in the next sentence here, there was great indignation against Israel. And I tried to look and get a good definition. What does that little phrase there really mean? And I got different readings based on different writers that are talking about it, whether the indignation that Moab had against Israel, whether it was the Lord against Israel for driving it so hard that the king would come in and actually do that and sacrifice his son, or did the Israelite army itself see what they had done and how far they had pushed it, even though God had told them to, and God had told them what to do through Elisha as far as running the land and cutting out the trees. So anyhow, a little confusing to me exactly what that phrase means and who had the indignation against who from that. But it was not a good scene when the king of Moab goes in and takes his son. And so the last sentence there says they picked up at that point and they went home. So. Oh, yes. Yes. And that's why this phrase comes in to be so confusing there, because that was very, very disturbing, totally wrong. It's not the only time we see it happening like that when they offer their children to idol gods and things like this. But they did this, and some of the commentators will think and say the Israelite army had pushed it too far and drove into this. They should not have done that. I have a little bit of a hard time with that because they were essentially going in and destroying the land like God told them to. Is it just part of their normal worship to go in, but they think they, the only way to appease their gods and down to this point is offering their son like that for sacrifice? Was God displeased with the Israelites for pushing it this far? I don't think so. But they had done what he told them to. So, but the whole thing is not pretty to us or to God or anybody else. Scott, go ahead. No. definitely no doubt about that. What Scott's saying, those of the far side, I can't hear. Lot was a righteous man. But Lot made some very, very bad decisions. Lot made some decisions that got his family into major trouble. And that's where the descendants came from. That's where the Moabites and Ammonites came from, was from Lot and the incest with his daughters with him. And so, as the degradation has gone so far now to where offering their children to the people of Moab was nothing. They just progressively spiraled down and down and down. And Scott's point is that decisions made by us can have long-term effects. Things we do, decisions we make, may affect our families for future generations that we don't know about at this point. So be very careful with that. Okay, anybody else? Thoughts? Okay, as usual, simple things like to talk about. And first one we've talked about before, but to me it's just worth talking about again. Go back to verse 11 in this chapter, where the armies have come together, and Jehoshaphat says, "Is there not a prophet of the Lord that we may inquire of him before we go into battle?" That's the same thing Jehoshaphat did when he was teamed up with Ahab to go to battle against Syrians and try to reclaim the city of Ramoth-Gilead. But Jehoshaphat wanted to know what the Lord had to say about it. Now, I kind of mentioned this going through it. Who's with Jehoshaphat? It was two idol-worshiping kings. You think they care what the Lord had to say about anything? Not really. Okay. So, Jehoshaphat, and the point I'm trying to get to here is, he's standing up. Standing up for what's right when we're outnumbered. Jehoshaphat's here with two idol-worshiping kings, and what does Jehoshaphat speak up and say? I don't know what the Lord says about this. Okay? What's God say? That's what matters to me. And I'm bold enough that I can speak up here in front of these two kings that would care less who Jehovah was, and even so crossed with Elisha that when they come before Elisha, Elisha says, I don't even talk to you. That's kind of where he was with Jehoram and their wickedness in Israel. But Jehoshaphat stands up for what's right. And there's lots of the things we think about along the same line. Think about Noah. Noah lived in a world that's described how in the first part of Genesis 6. Totally, totally wicked. And yet Noah's called a preacher of righteousness in this totally ungodly world he's in. Building this ark. Standing up for what God told him to do. You think about Noah. Or you can think about Daniel. Or the book of Daniel. It's actually Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Think about this gold statue that the king Nebuchadnezzar has built. And when the music sounds, what's everybody supposed to do? Everybody bows down to this golden image that Nebuchadnezzar has built. It's built, and the music starts. You just see everybody bowing down. And these three people standing up. About standing out in the crowd. Standing up. And Nebuchadnezzar comes to him and says, is it true? Is it true that you don't serve my gods? And you're not going to bow down to my image? And he says, we're going to play the music again. We'll get another chance, in other words. We'll play the music again. And the fire furnace is here. And they said, don't worry about it. Play the music. Heat the furnace up. We don't serve your gods. And we're not going to worship the golden image. So about being different. Stand up for what's right. Jump over to the New Testament. Acts chapter 4. Peter and John brought into prison. What were they told? Don't preach this stuff about Jesus anymore. Don't do it. And they said, that's what you say. But we're going to do what's right. We're going to talk about the things we've seen and heard. What was Jesus' commission to them? Go preach, right? So what's Peter and John saying they're going to do? Put us in prison. Do what you have to us. No matter. What we're going to do? We'll do what's right. Let's stand up for what's right sometime. We have to take our belief, and our belief and our faith strong enough that we're faced with situations where we're the odd person, if you will, okay, or we're the one that has to step up and say, yes, this is right, or no, this is not right. We have to have the boldness to do that beyond the circumstances. And it kind of comes down to this same verse here, Matthew chapter 5. Let your light shine. You can't turn it off, turn it on when you want to. Well, you can. You should. Or I should. Okay. All right. Another thought that I get from this is by asking God. Todd Spant wanted to know what God said. He wanted to talk to the prophet of God, inquire of the Lord. So not only is he standing up in the middle of these two idolatrous kings, he wants to know what God said about it. And God tells us to ask. We want something from him. Ask. Don't look at him as a far-off being that's beyond our reach out there somewhere. He appeared to Solomon before he made him king. He says, what can I do for you? Ask, and I'll give it to you. Ask me. Martha, the death of Lazarus, was talking to Jesus. Of course, wanted him to have been there before Lazarus died. And she tells Jesus, says, talk to God. He said, whatever you ask for, he'll give you. Ask. Ask. Then those passages in James chapter 1 we're very familiar with. If you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. He gives to all men liberally. And ask in faith. Don't doubt. That's the part that gets us sometimes. We've got two things. Number one, we've got to ask. Number two, we've got to do it believing that God can do it. Ask in faith. Jesus tells his disciples in John 14, says, what have you asked in my name? With the next few words. That I will do. They go back and look at a couple of examples of kind of where this has happened. Think about Hannah, when she's in the temple praying, and Eli saw her, and she was asking for a son. She said, I'll dedicate him back to you, but give me a son. She asked. She went before the Lord and asked for something. Nehemiah chapter 1. I'll read the two or three verses before you get to verse 4 here. Words of Nehemiah came to pass the month of Chilspit, 20th year, I was in Shushan, the citadel. And I, when my brethren came with men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped and survived the captivity concerning Jerusalem, they said to me, the survivors who are left in the captivity and the prophets that are there in great distress and reproach, the walls of Jerusalem are broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. The word got back to Nehemiah, who's still up in Babylon, about the situation back in Jerusalem. And it says, Nehemiah says, when I heard these words, I wept. I sat down and cried because the situation back in Jerusalem was so bad. But the next thing he did was what? He prayed to God about it. Looking for a solution. Nehemiah's little men that led a contingent of people back to Jerusalem. This is the rest of that. He prayed. Oh God, great, awesome God. Talk to him. Listen to my prayer. Look at verse 6. Please let your ear be attentive, your eyes open. Hear the prayer of your servant. All these people are asking God for things. That's what God wants us to do. Hezekiah, he was sick. He was about to die. What did he ask God for? Asked him for time. Give him 15 more years on his life. And we talked about this verse quite a bit in here already. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man. Fails much. So don't forget to ask God. You got a problem, you need help, go to God with it. I'll do that. Okay, I got one more to tack on here. This is a little personal thing. As I go through these chapters, I've mentioned before, a lot of times I'll listen on my earbuds while I'm on the treadmill. Each time you read through a chapter, or in this my case, listening to it being read, sometimes a phrase will catch you that you hadn't picked up on before. As I was listening to this, I think it was yesterday morning, chapter 3, where we are here in verse 20, phrase is used in the morning about the time when the offering was being made. One version says. The other says about the time of the offering of the sacrifice, the morning sacrifice. If you try to look at that a little bit, again, there's different thoughts about what was going on. The army's out in the field for battle. It's early in the morning, sunrise. It's the time that the priests back in Jerusalem will be making the morning sacrifices. It's that time. They set time. I think I'll show you a passage of it that mentions the evening sacrifices. Elijah talked about that. So there's a set time for the morning sacrifice, the evening sacrifice. And see, they might stop and turn themselves toward Jerusalem and think about what's going on back in Jerusalem at that time. But my point is, there's a specific time for it. And here comes my problem. It's my personal thought. I was going to work every day. As I would go through the Tanner traffic light, going to Decatur, between the Tanner traffic light and as I get over down to the causeway going across the river, about 10 minutes of time there, and traffic's usually pretty calm. It's just a straight, open stretch of traffic. And that was my time. Before I got to work, before I got my day started good, that I got my prayer time. And Bill and I have talked about this before. Here's my problem. Now that I'm like some of these other old folks in here retired, I don't get up and go to work every day like that. So I don't go past that traffic. Light and Tanner. It's a lot of clicking on. Okay, this is your time. So I'm having a hard time getting my life readjusted and figuring out, okay, what is my time? Where do I set aside that time for my prayer time, or my meditation time, my thought time? And this little phrase called me with that. It said, there's a time for the morning sacrifice they have. And if you go all over, there's some others in Mount Carmel. Toward the end of the day, there came time for the evening sacrifices Elijah was talking about. And think about Daniel. Three times a day, he had his specific time that three times a day Daniel would look back toward Jerusalem. That was his custom, his routine thing. I know most of y'all don't have this little problem, but here's another thing about it. There's a commentary from Matthew Henry. Where they had their specific times that God had told them to make their sacrifices. We don't have that. Because our intercessors there, our high priest is there all the time. So it's not morning sacrifice, evening sacrifice. My only point to think about here is, and the problem I'm trying to deal with, I know a lot of you don't have this problem, is to find that specific time to plan it in my life. Well, this is my prayer time. This is my meditation time. I changed my life routine. I don't drive through my traffic light at Tannery anymore. So, I know that's getting a little off on my problem, not yours, but yeah, that phrase has caught my attention a little bit through here. Okay, thoughts from anybody? There's the Kings up here again. You got them all in your mind. Pick up and go from here. I don't even have any books. What's the lesson 13? As far as the scriptures concerned. I'll get back into 2 Chronicles next time. So look at your sheets. 2 Chronicles 20 and 21 and the book of Obadiah come into play next time. So, out of the Kings over the Chronicles for a couple of chapters here. Okay, thanks very much.